Reverend Davis, Reel 5.
And of course, one felt it was a great triumph, really, because in that lecture room, and behind us, as I celebrated the communion, you have these great portraits of all the world's communist leaders. You've not had great pictures of Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, Mao Zedong, Ho Chi Minh, and Slansky. And I regret to tell you, very much regret to tell you, the Red Dean of Canterbury, the late Dr. Hewlett Johnson. There he was. And paradoxically, ironically enough, anyway, one says, celebrating the union here with the international leaders of an atheistic movement which was going to erase Christianity from men's minds. What a triumph that, in spite of all that, somehow we'd been given bread and wine, and here we were having the central act of Christian worship, the Holy Communion, in this Chinese and North Korean communist prison camp. Anyway, very, very, very wonderful, and everyone's spirits were greatly raised. Everyone who communicated, their memories revived, their spirits were greatly raised, and they went back to the camp breakfast, which was going to be a special Christmas Eve. Every prisoner was going to be given five tailor-made cigarettes. They were going to be issued with sake, that awful potato whiskey. Each man was given a little measure of sake to drink, and greatest thing of all, we were to be given a small portion each of pork to eat with our rice, something we've not had since captivity. Anyway, when the men had gone away, it remained to me to reverently consume the what remained of the small bottle of wine and the loaf of bread, the small loaf of bread used for communion, kind of dough bread. There were just a few fragments left, and I reverently consumed those quietly myself, and collected my kettle of prawns, one crossed back to my squadron with me, and my little cup, the chalice, and I will use that cup later for my cup of the Vendor's cup of tea. I wanted to use that for my drinking, and my one half of the mess tin. And as I did so, one piece of scripture rose to my mind like something rising to the surface of a pool. One particular verse of scripture from the first epistle of St. John in the New Testament. And it's this. And I looked up at the pictures of Slansky and Stalin and Mao Zedong and Lenin and the rest of the Martin. This is the victory that overcometh the world, even your faith. This is the victory that overcometh the world, even your faith. And I thought that summarized for me the whole of that day, how it all happened. And so I went back to the squad room and had our Christmas breakfast. And inevitably, with the sake, some men were training their sake for the extra cigarettes, and some men got hopelessly drunk. Human nature risks this. But it's all to be forgiven, I'm sure. But we had our communion, and that was a great thing against all odds. And we'd established that fact. And of course, we had one more Christmas communion before release in 1952. In fact, two then, because the Chinese had taken half the camp away to Pearl Camp number two further down the road. We were Pearl Camp number one. And to my amazement, after discussing it, going through procedure with Wong about it, Ding, they allowed me to go on the armed guard down to Camp 2 with bread and wine, so with me there, because there's my own camp. So, I must give that to the Chinese, they allowed that. But let me tell you that I had to go through a tremendous censorship of the religious service. You had to write everything out that you were going to sing or say the prayers, even the Our Father. And I can tell you, if you are listening to a man who's written out for the censors the words of the Our Father more than any other clergyman alive. Right. I set off several times to accompany the comrade Chen Chunwei, who did the censoring. I said, comrade Chen, all Christians say this prayer. We call it the Lord's Prayer every service. I've written it out about 6 times now. It never changes. No, you must not fight it. Boy, I have to spend about 2 hours on Thursday afternoon before each week writing down the words of any prayers. And of course, they say, what are you going to say? I said, well, I'm not able to tell you now what I'm going to say. It is all religious teaching. It is not political. And you find that one of them is speaking commissars quietly in the back of the congregation, just listening. But the prayers and hymns and the Our Father had to be written out. So that was a great bore to do that. But then I would sit with Chen, and I would sit there for best part of 2 hours in paper, pencil, wax before he then took them away.
Did they ever insist on anything being cut out?
Yeah, they did at Christmas time. I'll tell you about that. They did. And you were asking me about what I think about the Chinese. And earlier on in this conversation, I was telling you, Chinese unpredictability is another thing. And another thing is Chinese naivety, I found. Naivety, one thing I felt about them too, certain naivety. For instance, now, we had to submit, we were going to have, after the communion, they had 11 o'clock in the camp lecture room, a general Christmas sing-song, singing our own carols and songs, you see, everyone coming forward to everyone. And again, I had to go and see the gentleman where he says, and write down what we're going to sing. It had to be submitted to Wong and the others for approval. I wrote out, of course, the words of the King Mrs. Astrid Doubt on the Feast of Stephen and that sort of thing. And other things we're going to sing as well as I can remember. And to my surprise, a day later, Chen Chunwei said to me, you cannot sing that good invented that one. Can we see Chen was interpreting this time, Chen and Young interpreting too. The man would be disappointed. Because it is a song which tells us about a rich king going out to a poor man. This is all about bourgeois philanthropy. We are going to establish a society in which there will be no kings, and when the dictatorship of the proletariat is established, there will be no poor men. And the other thing, the Chinese want to sing a thing about my little grey home in the West. It's when a man has finished his work, he wants to go back and retire to his little grey home in the West. That wasn't allowed, because in the new society we are creating, no one will want to retire to his little grey home in the West. He will want to work hard in the factory, in the workshop, and he will not want to retire to a little grey. And we were actually staggered by this, abused, of course, but then we couldn't sing those things. There was the threat of being punished for the rest of the thing being stopped. But that's an example of a kind of Chinese naivety, really. And I found it. Again, just breaking off this thing for a moment, you would, sort of in his lectures, one of his favourite things was, he said, we know at this moment when I am talking to you that in America and in London a terrible chauvinistic, warmongering play and songs are being sung. Wondered what this would be. It is a terrible American warmongering play called Annie, Get Your Gun. So that he not only couldn't understand it, he was furious. Bang, called the pen, called the guard, left the rifle butt on the floor. But that's an extraordinary thing. He was a serious and, I suppose, reasonable, well-educated young man. Again, he would tell us that he would describe to us conditions in your country, in England, in Britain. He would describe to us conditions which may have been true when Engels was assisting in the writing of Das Kapital with Marx, you know, when Engels mentioned it. We use the time to open the stuff with it. We'd say, son, this is not so. This is all in England about 120, 30 years ago. It's all changed. We now have a welfare state. And we would say, people, you don't find lots of people outside the rich houses rooting in the dustbins for food to eat and that sort of thing. And you don't find this and that. And, you know, some would give you a most Dickensian picture of England. And he would say, we would say, how do you know these conditions? Have you been to England, sir? And he would basically say, no, not yet, I've not been to England. But how do you know? Because everywhere we have our comrades living there with your people, you don't know who they are. They report to us what is happening, so we know what life is like in America and Britain. And you couldn't get someone away from that. And he obviously had the most extraordinary naive impressions of what life was like in Britain in the 1950s. And you might know poverty and less and there are very unfair things which we have to try as a country to correct and so forth. But the picture painted by Sun of life in England by the downtrodden proletariat was utterly naive and exaggerated to an extraordinary degree. However, I think I've broken my line of thought. We finished the Christmas service and gone back to our warm years. And we had our sing song, we were the bits that had been censored. In January, a day or two after Christmas, we were all assembled together in the camp lecture room, all the prisoners, including Colonel Carney, not yet been taken away, and Colonel Brown, Senior Bacon, and also. And Wong said, now, the camp commander knows that you're all very, very grateful to us Chinese and to General Mao Zedong for allowing you to have your Christmas service. We know you call yourself Christians, and we also know that if you are a Christian, you must have a good conscience, one would lecture us, and your good conscience will tell you all that you must send a message of greeting in thankfulness for all we've given you to General Ping Tihuai, who is commanding our forces at the front. We've prepared this great big Christmas card, and in the next day or two, we'll have it taken down, delivered personally from this prison camp to General Ping Tihuai, the commander at the front of our Chinese Field Army, the 6th Field Army, I believe. He said, every officer will file past and sign it. And we sat there absolutely dumbfounded, silent. And our Colonel Tom came on quietly began possible to come. No. Sat there. And then said, well, come on. The front row officer, you will all file out back to your squadron. As you file out, you will sign it. Nobody would. Nobody would. And the field officer would forbid any officer, whatever, not that we would have done, any officer to go forward and sign it. The Chinese were clearly a bit surprised about this, the Chinese discussion being involved with that. Wong said, we give you another 5 minutes, then the first officers must come out and sign. Nobody moved out. I said, we all sat there. We all knew that the die had been cast. If they were going to bring the machine guns and kill a lot of us, that was it. You get that stage. Nobody moved. This was just 2 days off Christmas, and the day off Christmas. Then, this time, they began to get furious, so we get now nearly half an hour gone by. Long said, everyone will come forward and sign this card and march out of the room. Everybody. There's no excuse for anybody to do it. You must do this, the right thing you must do. And if you do not do this, you will be kept in here without food until you die. There'll be no cow call tonight. Lord Jackia. Is that there? And I can remember. At the back of the nursery, some men, naturally, and they want to be moving it, could go out. They just have to do it on the floor, you know, the floorboard. Sat there. Past midday, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. We're just sitting there, talking quietly among ourselves, and feeling, you know, this could be the end. And it got to dusk was falling, and then to our immense surprise, believe it or not, we suddenly heard across the square, "Joe! Joe!" from the cookhouse. The cookhouse men hadn't been brought into the lecture. They escaped mostly that they worked in the cookhouse. One came back, he left various people in turn sitting on the platform with Charlie Bart. One son of them came back. He just spilled into that room and the Chinese story was banged off all that rifle bust time. "Get back to your squads and watch out."
The Chinese soldiers banged with their rifle butts?
The silence on the floor. See, we just murmured each other. I said, "Oh, they would bang on the floor. Those who carried rifles, they'd bang on the floorboard like that." Some had some automatic weapons, other than had rather old fashioned rifles. This would be our speech of those two in the mornings to rouse us, especially in the winter mornings. So that was the end of that. And Chinese unpredictability. We didn't know whether we were going to be just left there until we just slowly starved. "You will get no more food," he said, about 11 o'clock. Ah, it's unforgettable. And so we went back to our sconces, and our buckets went to the chow, and the life resumed again, and no more was said by the Chinese. The famous greeting card of General Bing Tiwai, who only died, I believe, a few years ago in China. Haven't they had some trouble, I gather, with the Chinese Communist apologies about the Clemens Fairfield, possibly? He died. Anyway, was not very much in favour, I believe, of the General Bing Tiwai. Anyway, life went on, but one January afternoon, suddenly, and we were against it, talking to Colonel Farmer. Suddenly, the other guards came and said, "Connie, take all bring with," that means take your few little possessions that you had, come with. Colonel went. And Dennis Harding was called out, and Colonel Brown was called out. They were away from us for several days. We all assembled in the next room, and one said, "Because of your attitude about the Christmas card we want to send to General Bing Tiwai, because of your obstructionist attitude and your lack of gratefulness, what we've done, Colonel Kahn, Colonel Brown, Major Harding, they will be punished in solitary confinement." So we were all suffering on the cross, really, but they were away from us for about 10 or 12 days. We all assembled again one morning in the camp lecture room, not for lecture, but for this Chinese trial. We all assembled there, freezing cold, and Wong was there, dingling their padding uniforms. The Chinese, by this time, incidentally, had issued us with blue padding uniforms with the medals from the design of cold. We all squatted there, and all Chinese camp staff were there. And in between armed guards was brought Colonel Kahn, Colonel Brown, Colonel Harding. They looked terrible. I mean, they were literally blue with cold, shoulders hunched. They'd been sitting all that time in unheated windowless cells on a bit of rice each day, nothing to read, nothing to smoke, nothing. Just left with their thoughts until they were pressurized to make their self-confessions. One of these great communist things, you know, in the Chinese. party members, and you can possibly find it. They stood before us, those three men, object. Sights, really, and misery, and blue with cold, hunched together. They had an awful time. The Chinese hadn't laid hands on them, no need to. After long speech, Ding said, these evil-minded men who tried to stir up trouble and prevented you from signing the card for General Pinky White will now read their confessions. What a terrible thing for us in the Gloucesters to watch our own highly respected commanding officer stand and read a confession to us. It was a masterpiece. Having given his name and number of rank, and he was going to have to do. He then, in a quite brilliant way, really, confessed to all the things we'd expect him to do as a commanding officer, namely, I can't remember the precise words at this stage, but confessing to he'd done his best to influence the junior and younger officers at his command against the indoctrination lectures he had. When he confessed to forbidding his officers to sign the greetings card to General Pinky White at the front, he confessed to not cooperating with Chinese. He confessed to it, and of course, again, Chinese Navy, they were quite pleased with that. We, of course, wanted to clap. He was making the correct confession, what the Chinese thought he would. So he made, and Hardingham Down very much the same. The Chinese then said, they will all be taken away now, and in the case of Connie, it will be 6 months solitary confinement. His case will then be reviewed, and if he's relaxed his attitude, and if he will cease to influence his officers against us, he may be released. If not, he will never return from solitary confinement. I just add here that he never returned from solitary confinement to General Card. He never gave one jot. He was released to us after 19 months, just after the armistice had been declared and the exchange of prisoners was about to take place. That was in August 1953. Colonel Harding and Colonel Brown, they were kept for long periods, and eventually they managed by some means or other to say something to the Chinese. They were eventually released to a sort of, for a short time, then taken away again and placed in little tiny compounds, not cells, but little compounds where they just had to walk and live and eat alone for months on end. Dennis Harding was eventually released from that when they made the new camp number 2 down the road. So his last couple of months he was released after a long period of solitary. But the man they really went for was Khan. So that was the upshot. So that was the last time that Colonel Khan was able to receive communion in the prison camp. And the rest of the time, those 19 months, he was in rigorous assault and confinement. And he died just like it is his birthday here in Gloucester. And Dennis Harding died on the morning of Holy Saturday, Easter.
From the religious point of view, from the Christian point of view, what would you think the general effect on the British POWs was? Did it tend to make them more cynical, or did it tend to strengthen their faith, or did it just vary with the individual?
Before we broadcast this, before we take, we're not taking this.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Well, I would say as chaplain, first of all, if I can just double on a bit and say, but when you think of any man entrusted to your care as chaplain, obviously you are deeply concerned about their personal welfare and family welfare at all levels, quite apart from any distinct religious belief. You will find, I think, considerable number of your soldiers whose knowledge of Christianity is probably very minimal, you will find soldiers who wouldn't even be able to recite properly fully the Lord's Prayer without being placed in front of them. You will find others who've come from what we shall call perhaps a religious home and have been used at some stage in their lives a fairly regular church going and Sunday school. You will find with all the soldiers and officers some residue, shall we put it, of Christian faith. But then for many of them it will be a very minor one. You will find hardly any of the poor antipathy to you as padre. None, I would think. And no antipathy towards the Christian faith. What you will understand, what you will find, is a lot of a lack of understanding, a lack of teaching in earlier life, and a lack of any real desire to join in what they would, many of them would see in a very amiable way, as a somewhat irrelevant and out-of-date practice worship here. On the other hand, you will find among your officers a high percentage, of course, of people who've had a lot of church going or chapel going in their lives. Many of them have come from homes where the church attendance and Christian instruction has been taken for granted. But I mean, also among some of your officers, you will find people who are in a non-hostile way, agnostic, or extremely sceptical. So you've got a typical bunch of humanity, all of whom, as chaplain, you have to get to know and love them, and care for them, whether they are churchgoers, believers, or not. So I would have to say that first. So now we come to the question in the prison camp. My impression in the prison camp is that a lot of men ask themselves quietly, why have I survived the battle, for instance? Why was so-and-so killed at my side? Why have I been allowed to live on? Why am I now approaching the end of this captivity, perhaps going to be released? And I've got a lot to be thankful for, in spite of being a prisoner here. What might this mean for my life if ever we get home again? So I think questions are raised along these lines in many men's minds. I found among those who were already fairly active church-going Christians, like Tony Fowler Hockley, for instance, who had always been a very strong church, and Dennis Hardy and others, Colonel Kahn, I found no cynicism or no relinquishment of faith at all. I would say I would find a much deeper stress on prayer and the value of prayer, and a greatly strengthened belief in the providence and overriding goodness of God. I can just think of one young officer who'd been to a well-known public school with a long Anglican tradition, who told me that he had become, in the years just previous to being captured, very much agnostic, and felt that he could no longer believe